Great, we have the recording. We also have a slight delay. So if John and I pause, it's just because we don't want to actually speak over each other. But I'm delighted to welcome Jonathan Drury to our session here at The Garden and the Hedge. John Tummo and I actually all met together in Oulu back in, and Maria also, who has the piece Flowers of Evil. So there feels like a circle of life that seems to kind of return us and connect us. Jonathan was born and raised in London, is known for as a best-selling author and a trustee in many organizations, which I will speak to in a second. His books Around the World in 80 Trees and Around the World in 80 Plants have been translated into 20 different languages. And prior to focusing on his writing, he was the co-founder of the UK government's digital culture online program, and prior that was an executive producer, Fisher and digital. So he is quite well known for his work transdisciplinary, and so has been a Eden Pro. I've followed into Jonathan. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm good actually. We have builders here, of course. That's par for the course when you've got any kind of quiet studio kind of work that you want to do. Hello everyone. I noticed that the quality of the line from your end at least got a lot worse when we started the session, so it could be that there's limited bandwidth at your end and lots of people are online suddenly doing something. I don't know.
Ah, good to know. Okay, so if anybody is streaming hard, we can reduce it at the moment. So, Jonathan, let's open with, I guess, the sessions here are considered a sort of conversations that we are recording, which is basically for our archive purposes. But Around the World in 80 Trees came out in 2019, correct?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Followed by Around the World in 80 Plants. What was the impetus? What was the reason for these books? And how did you go about, I guess, selecting the trees or the plants that were in the program or in the book?
I think that the impetus came actually a long, long time ago, though I didn't realize it at the time, when I was about sort of 8 or 9 years old. And my parents used to drag my brother and me around the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, which is to the southwest of London. My father was very interested in botany. My mother was interested perhaps more in the aesthetic side of plants. And between them, the way that they motivated us to be interested was by two things. One, that they used to feed us bits of the plants, and that was always quite an interesting experience. And secondly, they told us stories about the plants. And the stories they told were bits of folklore, bits of culture, quite a lot of science. And when I later in life, just a few years ago, was looking for books that would kind of encompass science, history, folklore, and not compartmentalize these, but actually sort of bring the ideas together. I couldn't really find anything, so I thought, well, maybe this is the time to try and write something. So that was the impetus. And then in choosing the particular species, there are 60,000 tree species, so choosing 80 trees was not the easiest thing to do. And my first criterion was, could I find a tree or a plant that meant something to a particular culture where, because this is the conceit is going around the world. So I wanted something for each country that I chose. Secondly, I needed a variety of different kinds of trees so that the scientific stories would be sufficiently different from each other. And then I needed to make sure that everything was, that each biography of a tree, if you like, of a tree species, would contain something that was surprising to someone, even if they were an expert. So there are different angles within it. And there are some where I just couldn't find the stories that hadn't been told or that I felt were interesting enough. So those were the sort of key criteria, really.
Thank you. And did you have a sort of direct encounter with most of these trees? From the way that you write, it really feels like that you have.
Yes, I mean, most of them, I would say, not all of them in situ. So some of them were in botanic gardens, which I think are the most fantastic places. And some of them, obviously, I've been fortunate enough to go on various botanical expeditions and so on with some of the organisations I've worked with, where I sort of slid myself into the team as a photographer and filmmaker, rather than as a botanical expert. But the so most of the species I have encountered one way or another.
Thank you. I guess that leads a little bit on to the question about the entanglement, the colonial entanglements that often kind of pop up in relation to questions around botanical gardens. And as a long-standing trustee of Kew Gardens, what's your thoughts around how to, I guess, bring awareness to those issues, or also to actually reconcile or repatriate, perhaps in some way?
This is a really important question. The botanic gardens, we see them now as being, probably the public see them as being kind of lovely spaces that you can go and enjoy and wonder at the variety of nature, and they certainly are that. And secondly, people who are a bit more in the know probably realise that botanic gardens, by definition, actually, do scientific research, so they help to work out how to propagate and germinate plants and so on, and how plants work. And that's all very important and very good. But of course, that story about how you propagate and germinate plants 250 years ago was a very different story. So the botanic gardens of that era, of the kind of principally of the 18th century, so Kew Gardens was set up in 1760 or something. They were established in order to be able to take plant material from various parts of the empire, the British Empire in this case, and work out how to plant those and propagate them in other parts of the empire. And the motive was profit. And so that plant material was often either stolen or smuggled or negotiated in the way that the colonial powers negotiated, if you can imagine that. Whole industries were built up. So, for example, rubber was taken from Brazil and planted in Malaysia or Malaya as it was then. Which was a sort of fantastic business, and Britain had the monopoly on rubber for a long time, which incidentally Henry Ford tried to break that monopoly by setting up plantations of his own in Brazil, which didn't work out. But if you go to the Amazon rainforest, then in the middle of the rainforest right now, there's the mouldering, former city that he built up to cultivate rubber, which is called Fordlandia. And it's a terrific place to go and take photographs of sort of forgotten industry, so there is absolutely a very strong colonial connection. When I grew up, as a child in the sort of 1970s, the history lessons that I had kind of glossed over the whole colonial story, really. Our history was kings and queens of England, and how if we were talking about the empire than it was how brilliantly the British had created the railway system in India or whatever it was. It was all very sort of positive gloss. And my parents did tell me another story, but I never really thought about it terribly much until I was researching these books, actually. And I learned so much about the movement of plants around the world, which you don't have to dig very far. There's very obvious examples in cotton and in sugar that are very clearly connected with the slave trade. But there are all sorts of other examples, like rubber, like gutta percha, these various sort of products which have been moved around by colonial powers through the ages. And it's not always a very comfortable story.
No, I agree, and thank you. And actually, I guess the gutta percha, which we were talking in preparation for this conversation, is a tree that I've also spent a lot of time looking at, because that latex was used for the early telecoms industry and laying of the cables and the undersea cables. So it actually was completely destroyed. And actually, I wanted to ask you, the seeds that came from Brazil for rubber that were propagated in Kew Gardens. Was that link made after the gutta-percha was destroyed, in a sense, or was it part of the time frame where they were
No,
trying to?
yeah. So just to for the sake of people who don't know, gutta percha is a tree that grows in principally in native to Borneo, Malaysia, that region, and trees need to protect themselves from wounds and through which bacteria and fungi can get in and so on and insects, and so a lot of trees have resins or latexes. That either kind of poison, or sterilize, poison bacteria, sterilize the wound, or seal the wound. So latex is this sort of milky substance that you get from rubber trees and a whole lot of other plants, actually, that you're probably familiar with. And gutta percha has this latex, which also contains a rubbery material. It's not exactly the same as the rubber tree rubber, it's slightly different. And it has this amazing property that it can be sort of coagulated, and then you can heat it in hot water and shape it into something like a little booty or a sort of a funnel or whatever it is, or a knife handle as the indigenous people used to use it for. And then if you want, you can sort of dip it in hot water again and reshape it. So it's a wonderful material that sets solid. But you can reshape. And it turned out to be a very important component of not only golf balls and enabled the game of golf to become, sort of democratized, if that's the word for golf, but also, it was a material that would be a good insulator underwater. And that meant that the empire could have ca underwater cables carrying telephone conversations. It's very difficult to run an empire and communications if you're an island like Britain is, and you can't communicate over the water without sort of telegraph si signals from France and things and people with long telescopes. So that changed, those telegraph cables insulated with gutta percha changed the world. And to answer your question finally, that came much later than rubber. So the gutta percha thing was the mid 19th century. Rubber was way earlier.
Okay, thank you. No, that's sort of linked up some gaps in my own understanding. Thank you so much. In terms of, I guess, illustrating these stories, because there's such complexity and the way that you shape the story per plant and per tree, as you say, combines all of these elements, the actual biology of the tree, the culture uses, the significance of it. You have a wonderful collaboration with an illustrator, Lucille. Could you explain how that emerged and how you met, actually, and what you how do you see that role of, illustration or the graphic arts or other artistic mediums in articulating stories of plants and trees?
Yeah, I mean, it was the introduction came through my publisher, who had been looking for different illustrators, came across four or five people who they said, which of these styles most appeals to you. And I talked to a few people, and Lucille Clerc is a French artist living in London. And I felt that, first of all, there was a kind of rapport between us. She's, I don't think she'd mind me saying, she's sort of gloriously feisty and reinforced every stereotype I had about the French in a good way. She was able to take the sort of, I gave her mood boards of, electron micrographs and, scientific illustrations, and as well as sort of overall images of the kind of place that we were trying to illustrate and the sort of themes in the story. And then she would do a sketch and say, "Is this the kind of thing you meant?" And with a bit of backwards and forwards between us, that worked really well. I think it helps if you kind of like and trust someone. Occasionally, if she couldn't find something in the mood board, that she would go off to the internet, which is a very, very dangerous place to go. So I would look at this, jungle in the Amazon with amazing, illustration. I'd think to myself, "Hang on, that's a an oak tree in the background. What's that doing there?" And she'd say, "Oh, well, I just thought it looked nice, so I'll put it in." So her, she was driven by the aesthetics, perhaps more than, or as a higher priority than I was, and I was driven by, wanting it to be absolutely beautiful, but also accurate. And so there was always a little bit of pleasant and happy bickering, I would say, between us.
Nice story, and thank you for sharing sort of the background to the collaboration as well. I guess it, in terms of actually educating, because this is one of I feel like it's how we connected over the years and at different points as well, and this kind of combination of digital culture and education. What do you think, given the kind of current climate sort of scenarios that we're facing and climate denial in a sense, what for you is important to articulate in relation to what might be considered as a plant blindness, or in a way, or our lack of understanding perhaps, or maybe even over time we have, untangled ourselves from relationships with nature where we would have been a lot more sensitive to plant reproduction, for example, or the life cycle of a plant or a tree? Where do you sort of see the challenges
Yeah.
really? And
Okay,
what
so
from your stories, could kind of like help us orientate in that direction?
well, that is a huge question. So let me try and break it down. So first I'll talk about plant blindness, and maybe second come on to the sort of what I think are the most important things educationally. So plant blindness, I think human beings are sort of, we've evolved to pay attention, first of all, to the things that matter to us, and secondly, to things that move. So animals respond to things that move, high contrasts, changes, and so on. And if you live in a city, then plants, arguably, how they grow and where they grow and what they do, other than intellectually, doesn't really matter to us, right? Because food just arrives and clothing just arrives, and that's it. Because plants don't grow, don't move very fast, then we're, even those of us who live in cities, we're more programmed to look at birds or cats or foxes or whatever it is. So it's quite easy to become plant blind. Interestingly, I was on an expedition in the Andes with botanists, And I was looking at the most fantastic hummingbird that I'd ever seen. It was just the most amazing thing. And I called over one of the botanists to say, "Look, look, that's amazing, amazing." And he said, "Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. It'll be great when that bird gets out of the way and we can see that plant properly." Because and he had been programmed to be animal blind instead of plant blind. Moving on to in order to make people interested in plants and therefore want to protect them, they need to have the sort of knowledge and it sort of an emotional connection, I suppose, with plants. And that's what I was trying to do in the book without kind of saying so. On the education side, the thing that I wish people would understand better, because it is a miracle, is photosynthesis. So if I ask you a question, I mean, you, the audience here, a question which I just want you to answer in your head, which is a little seed weighs nothing. The acorn, for example, of an oak tree, weighs virtually nothing. And a tree weighs an enormous amount. And if you were to make charcoal out of that tree, a big, heavy bag of charcoal, you've got all that mass, all that stuff came from somewhere. And the question is, where did all the stuff come from? Now, I know from the research I've done here in the UK that about 85% of any audience you choose, whether it's children, scientists, journalists, anyone, about 85% of the audience will say the stuff came out of the ground. And that's interesting because I don't know how it is in Finland, but here we don't have people filling in the soil that the trees have sort of taken out of the ground in our streets. You don't have trucks driving around filling in all the soil. I have a pot plant that is absolutely huge, but I've never, ever had to top up the soil. Not once. I give it a few drops of baby bio every now and then, and some plant food. But the only thing that it seems to need is water. And it just grows and grows and grows. And the thing is that the mass of plants, the main bulk of the weight of plants, comes from just two ingredients, water and carbon dioxide. And the water comes up through the roots, and the carbon dioxide comes in through the air and through the leaves, right? So the carbon dioxide is a heavy gas. And this is the sort of the this is terribly important to understand if you want to think about climate change. So the reason it's really important to understand that is that about 360 million years ago, there were, all these vegetation growing. They were absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and taking up water through their roots in order to be able to turn into heavy stuff. And when they died, the old story we were told at school was that somehow they got squished and turned into coal. Well, I don't know, how things are there, but over here, when trees fall over, they don't seem to get squished. And even if you left them for a very long time, they wouldn't get squished. And the reason for that is that they decay. And when they decay, fungi attack them, bacteria attack them, and the carbon dioxide that was locked up in the wood is released back into the atmosphere. But 360 million years ago, bacteria and fungi hadn't learned yet how to do that. They hadn't evolved to be able to break down the woody stuff in wood. And therefore, all those trees that died, all the plants and vegetation that died, just sort of built up and didn't go anywhere. And for that reason, the fact that it didn't rot over a very long period meant that it could eventually get squished and turned into coal and oil. The oil came from little critters that lived on the plants. So for 60 million years, until the bacteria and fungi worked out how to rot wood and rot plants, for 60 million years, carbon dioxide was taken out of the atmosphere and locked up as coal and then as oil, the fossil fuels. And what we're doing is taking 60 million years' worth of carbon dioxide and releasing it in just a few human generations, just a few hundred years. And that is why burning fossil fuels is bonkers.
Wow, thank you for a very concise and accessible overview of the necessity of plants and trees to our lives, which I think came from the question of what it is to become more aware and more sensitive to these particular issues. I guess that leads me to sort of flow to the poetics, really, in a sense, because I think many of the people that are contributing to the garden and the hedge are in their own different angles, I would say, tuned into this, you know, from musicians that we've invited who are sort of tapping into either the, you know, sonifying plants and the internal kind of fluids, to those that are working with bringing us into a sort of frequency beat to maybe relax the body to think through these issues, because it sort of helps you to maybe focus your attention, to others who are working with plant dyes and natural inks, to actually reimagining how we can actually be more, I guess, conscious with the way that we develop tools and technologies. You have written so many beautiful stories, and I wonder if now is an opportunity for those who might not have read your books to get a little flavor of that expression that you have. And I'm thinking, really, either I'll leave it to you to choose the direction here, but perhaps nettle is a good point to start, because we've had so many nettles weaving their way into the garden and the hedge. I think it's an appropriate way. So, as I mentioned, we have removing defenses as a piece of video work. We were eating nettles last night. They come up as one of your key stories in your plant story. So I hand it over to you, Jonathan, to share a reading.
Thank you. I'll do that. So for each country, I tried to choose a plant that might excuse me, might kind of say something about the people of that country as well. So rather mischievously, I've chosen the nettle, and you'll see why for England. The nettle's separate male and female plants are an understated couple, trusting their pollen to the wind rather than insects. They have no need for gaudy blooms, but instead form little garlands of minute and subtle blossom. Female flowers dangle in strings like delicate lilac catkins, while the males form arches of cream or pink-tinged green and sport minuscule catapults that launch finger-length explosions of pollen into the air, an enchantment seen backlit on a summer morning. Nettles accompany us in life and in death, offering clues to our history. They thrive especially well on phosphate-rich soil, colonizing the fertilizer-fed margins of crop fields and following the phosphates that we ourselves accrete in the ash from our fires, in our waste, and in our bones. The banks of castle moats are still cloaked in nettles, feeding on the persistent minerals from sewage and refuse flung there hundreds of years ago. Given the chance, they thrive in churchyards. They spring up at the sites of ancient settlements, outcompeting other plants where the soil chemistry bears the imprint of human habitation. And they have even revealed to forensic investigators the location of buried bodies. Roman soldiers, unfortunate enough to be posted to the northernmost edge of their empire at Hadrian's Wall, attempted to alleviate their rheumatism, the seeping cold, and perhaps even their boredom, by urtication, flagellating themselves with nettles. It's true that in the right frame of mind, the recurrent fiery tingle is not wholly unpleasant, but it's a special kind of person who experiences the sensation as an aphrodisiac. Those people do exist, and urtication is practiced nowadays by those who prefer a little pain with their pleasure. There's something peculiarly British about the stinging nettle, partly for its potential for eccentricity and comedy, but also for its restrained yet welcome contribution of just a little mild peril to England's innocuous, green, and pleasant land.
Thank you so much. I feel a little clap is in order there. We were also, as I mentioned, the nettle, it comes up quite a bit in our exhibition, not intentionally. And I love the way that this perceived weed, in a way, has brought itself into a very present and foregrounded position in the exhibition. I'm curious to ask, what did you write about Finland, actually? I mean, I know what you wrote, but I'd like to hear your side of it.
The clue is in the cover of the book, the birch tree. I mean, and I think that the place where you are at the moment has birch in the title, Bjork something.
Culture House.
So, yeah, how could I not choose the birch for Finland?
And what could do you mind me? Would you be open to another little reading, actually, from
Yeah,
us?
sure. If my the building work means there's loads of dust in the air here, so I apologize for my coughing and spluttering and so on. So the birch, there's this wonderful drawing of that she's done, that Lucille has done. So I'll read a little piece about the birch. The birch has been revered for centuries for its ability to renew and purify and to subvert spells and sorcery. Some Finns still place birch saplings in doorways as symbolic protection. Birch twigs are sometimes infected by a fungus called Tafrina, which causes them to branch chaotically into tousled nests called witches' brooms, and these have supernatural associations in many cultures. While Tafrina attacks birch and causes haphazard growth, another more familiar fungus is the tree's partner. Trees often develop symbiotic relationships with mycorrhizal fungi, which intermingle with their roots and extend beyond them in a huge web of minutely thin filaments. These networks are especially good at extracting nutrients from the soil, which they pass on in an easily digestible form. In return, the fungus receives sugars from the tree. Individual tree species cooperate with particular fungi. The birch's life partner is Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric, whose fruiting bodies, the parts we see above ground, are scarlet with white sprinkles, the archetypal toadstools of every fairy tale. Fly agarics contain a cocktail of mind-bending hallucinogens around which all manner of shamanistic rituals have evolved, particularly among Siberian tribes and the Sami people of northern Finland and Sweden. So far, so human, many cultures have psychedelic traditions. However, the fly agaric's psychoactive ingredients are not completely broken down in the body, but excreted. This offers the enticing possibility of intoxication and a spot of social bonding by drinking the pre-drugged urine of others. It's true that northern nights are especially long, and the forests might have been lacking in other excitement. However, one can't help wondering whether this practice was really as widespread as the few historic travellers who seem to be the common source of all the shamanistic pea-drinking stories were told and so eagerly reported.
I guess on the psychotropic properties of plants, how far in your research did you go down that particular line? I mean, it's something that is extremely popular at this moment in time as well. I'm sure you have observed the amount of new events and developments that are sort of happening and I'd be curious to understand your position on it.
Well, I mean, it's sort of changing our senses, either to escape from reality or escape to something else. I mean, I think that's part of sort of human curiosity and a very sort of basic thing for human beings to want to do. And there are some things which are terrific to experiment with and great fun, and some things which where the fatal dose is so close to the psychotropically interesting dose that you wouldn't dare try them, and wouldn't encourage others to do so either. So there's a sort of continuum there. I mean, I do remember as a child, as I mentioned, one of the things that my parents used to do to jolly us along as we went round Kew was to feed us bits of the plants. And I remember him giving me a lick of an opium poppy, where he'd taken the sort of the seed pod and scored it with a knife, and it had its little latex coming out, latex again. And I licked it, and nothing much happened. It just sort of, to my memory, and this is a long time ago, I must have been about eight. I think it felt like having almost like a little numbness on my tongue or something. I don't know. Maybe he was suggesting that that would happen, and so I believed it. But much, much more exciting was the effect that that story had on my teacher, because I told my teacher very proudly that I'd had a lick of opium, and they sent a social worker around to talk to my mum, and it was like, absolutely fantastic. And here I am 50 years later, dining out on the story. I mean, what a fantastic effect of a completely non-psychotropic moment.
Oh, funny, 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 funny. I guess we're kind of like sort of like coming closer to the sort of the wrap of the conversation. What are you working on at the moment, actually? And
I've
would you
just,
be sharing it? Yeah.
yeah, I mean, I've just finished a literally, it's just gone to the printer, a book for children. I remember being interested as a child in these kind of stories that have that are not just science, not just folklore, and not just one thing or the other. The hard to compartmentalize stuff that where the interesting things happen at the boundaries between things. And so I've just written a book called The Stuff That Stuff Is Made Of, and it's about the things we make with plants. So it takes about 30 different species from around the world. Actually deals with quite difficult topics like slavery and colonialism, but in a way that is appropriate for a book for sort of 8 and 9 year olds and their families. It's not a complete downer, but it does deal with difficult topics head on, and has the things which will be surprising, whether it's about seaweed or chocolate or wheat or even gutta percha. The content is designed for that age group, beautifully illustrated by two illustrators, one from the Philippines and the other someone from Hong Kong living in London. So it has a sort of slightly Asian flavor to it, but the stories are from all over the world. And then I'm just about to start work on a book about fungi, again celebrating the individual species. So I want to try and make people feel an association and interest in and an understanding of the individual species rather than kind of fungi as a whole sort of mega group. And there are some that are obviously very familiar to people, like the fly agaric, the Amanita muscaria that I mentioned. But most, the number of fungi that most people can identify, are probably different in Finland, but it's certainly in many countries is just a handful. And there are so many more. And they have
Great.
interesting stories and interesting lives.
I guess there's a few people here in the audience that are also writers, and you shared a little bit about the process of working with an illustrator, but what's your daily rhythm as a writer, actually, if that's fair to ask,
I wish I had one. My wife is a proper writer. She's her name's Tracy Chevalier. She wrote Girl with a Pearl Earring, which you might know, and other books. And she writes historical fiction. She gets up at 8 o'clock in the morning and she writes until sort of after lunch, and she does 1,000 words a day roughly. And she's super, super well organized. I am always trying to fit writing in and around the other things that I do, because I'm on the board of various scientific organizations and involved in lots of other things, so that's difficult. The way that I find worst for writing, I've got lots of ways of failing at writing, I can tell you. The way that's worst is by sort of typing straight into the computer. And I find that I just get stuck. The way that I find best is to write longhand, as if I was writing just like a letter to a friend. So there's something about that process of hand and eye that for me really works well. And I notice that Tracy does the same thing. It may be that I've learned that from her, or it may be that that's just the way we do it. And then once I've got something on paper, then I key it into the computer and mess about with it. So that's
No,
the
interesting.
sort of technique. But the best bit of writing for me is the research. That's just a joy. And then the worst bit of writing is the getting something down, anything. And then the other best bit is editing. So I leave it for a couple of weeks, come back to it, and think, oh my gosh, that's terrible. But at least there's enough distance for me to be able to see, oh yeah, that's how I need to fix it. So the editing is quite fun.
You mentioned, thank you again for sharing the backstories that you mentioned, though, and be a bit remiss of me given the number of creative technologists that we have contributing to the Garden and the Hedge, that you're on the board of various organizations, one of which is Raspberry Pi. And does this work connect actually your work on plants and trees with Raspberry Pi, or how would you like to share a little bit about that? And we were having a little preamble before the official conversation opened, and you were sharing about, of course, the company's charitable status and the work that it's been doing. Would you mind?
Yeah. So actually, I've just finished my term at Raspberry Pi. In the UK, we have fixed terms for charity board members, trustees, as we call them. And so I've just stepped down after 8 years. Raspberry Pi is a company that is a it was a charity that was established to help children around the world learn computing rather than be idle consumers. And so at the time, this was about sort of 15 years ago, it needed to develop new technology, cheap computing, in order to be able to, kids to be able to program something that wouldn't cost an arm and a leg, and was also technologically easily accessible. It's very difficult to get into the workings of a Windows or an Apple computer. So those went on the market and became very popular in education. And of course, those devices are now specified by all those young people who use them in education and are now professional engineers. So they're in everything. So there'll be some wherever you are, basically. They're in cash registers, they're in cars, trains, planes, automobiles. All the systems that use background computing that don't necessarily look like computers have these devices in them. So that commercial part of what the charity had suddenly became very valuable. And we sold half of it on it floated it on the new on the London Stock Exchange. And instead of some sleazy Elon Musk type figure becoming filthy rich out of this, the charity made lots and lots of money, which goes back into helping children, learn. So that's great. And the company still owns just under half of the company, and the company itself is now worth $1 billion, I think, $1 billion dollars. And I hasten to add, the trustees in the UK are not allowed to benefit financially in any way. So I'm happy to say and proud to say I didn't make a penny out of this, which is exactly as it should be. And the so the more interesting part of your question, though, was about how does this sort of fit into everything else? And I don't know. I've sort of moved in my life from engineering to program making to having a strong interest in plant science. And I think that in the same way that in the books I've tried to combine history, culture, folklore, and science and juxtapose, you know, it's the juxtaposition of these that is interesting. In the same way that I've tried to do that, I think in the books I've tried to do that, or at least have fallen into doing that in my career. And the you know, so when people ask me, what do you do? it's quite difficult to answer because I do these different things. But on the other hand, you know, and that makes people sort of think, well, you know, does that mean you're not very good at anything? And that may be true. But some of the perhaps the value that I have is being able to look across completely different disciplines and spot the connections and the contrasts. And you know, and sometimes that's useful, a useful way of looking, maybe looking at the world. And it's certainly useful on a board of a company or a charity where it, you know, you need some people who are absolute specialists in a particular thing, like law. And maybe it's good to have some other people who can say, do you know what, that problem is a bit like this problem. But you know, you can see that there's a connection between something that other people might not spot. So I think there is perhaps a value in being able to see the connections and the contrasts between what most people might think of as being very different fields, and of course to make connections between the people who work in those fields. So you know, it's inspiring for me to work with you know, sort of artists or musicians. And as well as people who are kind of technologists, and I think that's why I'm so completely gutted and upset that I'm not actually with you in person. You were kind enough to invite me, and I was sick at the time and didn't want to commit to travelling. And it just sounds like the most fantastic group of people that you've put together, or that have coalesced somehow. And I wish I was there to be able to kind of hug everyone and sort of be part of the mycorrhizal network.
Well, I think that's a lovely note to leave on, and we wish you were here too, but we look forward to receiving you at Kubu in the future. Jonathan Drury, thanks so much for your time. I'm going to hand over to Tuomo Tampana, who is the co-founder of Kubu, for some final words. He's popped into the screen. Hi, Tuomo.
Thanks.
Are you
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear
Yeah,
you.
thank you. Thank you so much. It was really nice first start for the hybrid conversations, and obviously we would enjoy you physically present here with besides our birch trees and old pine trees. We just celebrated the opening with also the kind of the other exhibition of Pihapyhä Metsämaa, which is exactly about the old trees and celebration of the Finnish relationship within forest trees and nature. So this was a very, very suitable, very beautiful opening for our series. So thank you.
Thank
So
you. Thank you so much. It was a real honor to be with you. Thank you. have a lovely day, Jonathan, and see you soon. Thanks.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
I love you all.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Tuomo, I'm shutting down up here,
Yeah.
yeah?